Welcome to another episode of The Art Salon. My name is Nico Bejarano. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Share it with your friends and family. This really is the best way to help the podcast if you like it. And if you would like to support us with some money, you can do that through the Anchor website. Every little bit helps and is reinvested into the content. Today's guest is Stan Thompson. I'm going to read a short bio of him for those of you who are not familiar with his work. Stanford Thompson is a musician and educator who serves as the founder and executive director of Play On Philly and the founding board chairman of El Sistema USA and the National Instrumentalist Mentoring and Advancement Network. Recognized as a TED Fellow, Stanford believes that music is a powerful tool for positive personal and community change. Mr. Thompson serves on the faculty of the Global Leaders Program and regularly presents for major arts and business conferences, institutions, and stakeholders about leadership, entrepreneurship, and social justice. As a principal of Goldsmith Strategies, he has guided the strategic development of dozens of organizations across the United States while collaborating with local and national initiatives to develop new strategies and programs that provide equitable access to the arts. As a professional trumpeter, Stanford has performed as a soloist and member with major orchestras around the world and continues to perform throughout the Philadelphia region. Stanford is a native of Atlanta, Georgia, a graduate of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra's Talent Development Program, and holds degrees from the Curtis Institute of Music and the New England Conservatory's Sistema Fellows Program. I had been aware of Stan for a long time. He was first brought to my attention, like so many other people in my life, by Edward Carroll, who shared a TED video of his speaking about basically El Sistema and its benefits and the future for it in the United States. As you will hear in our discussion, I have very mixed feelings about El Sistema. I have mixed feelings about El Sistema for a number of reasons. I come from Colombia, where I have seen programs where you do after-school activities with at-risk or underserved communities with sports, soccer, art, etc. And in theory, music could be an integral part of this. Here's the problem. Music, as you will hear in our discussion, is incredibly costly. It's much more expensive than buying soccer balls or hiring a single coach to teach, you know, to coach a great number of kids. And so it makes it a little difficult to implement these programs in the third world. Nonetheless, El Sistema became an incredibly famous thing coming out of Venezuela. And why would that give me mixed feelings? Well, when I was very young, in the 90s, Venezuela was probably one of the richest countries in South America. Its development was actually staggering. It was a country that most other South American countries were jealous of. It had better infrastructure. It had some of the biggest oil reserves in the world, which means that the money that was flowing into the country was insane. And when there's money, there is corruption. However, Venezuela had what the former president of Colombia would describe as corruption in its just proportions, meaning the country had accepted a certain level of corruption in order to have expansive wealth, so to speak. Now, Venezuela and other South American countries since the colony have had a debt towards broader society. These have been countries with extremely rich elites and a small middle class and a large impoverished class with very few opportunities to advance. When you don't allow for class mobility, which is what the United States is so good at, you create resentment. And that resentment finally manifested in the election of a man named Hugo Chavez, who was a colonel in the army at the time, and who had a socialist dream that became known as socialism of the 21st century. Now, despite what that might sound like, the reality is that it was no different than what a lot of countries in South America had lived from the 1940s until maybe the 1990s in different forms. It was this idea that the state could control most of the resources, and for some magical reason, the state would not be as corrupt as private enterprise. Now, the thing that was revealed in all of South America in every age and the same around the world is that whenever state control comes into being and takes over every aspect of the economy, initially there is a boom. Why? Because the state all of a sudden has all these resources. So in that boom, there is kind of a fulfillment of a promise. And this is where populism is very dangerous. So Hugo Chavez promised, you know, we will cover your groceries. We will give everyone rent. We will build things. We will give you free education, etc. And for a couple years, he did. The problem is, when you take over an industry and you don't know how to handle it, that industry collapses. The case in point with Venezuela was actually its biggest industry, which was oil. When Hugo Chavez took over, Venezuela, like I said, had one of the biggest reserves of oil in the world. It still does. But it also had refineries. It had a whole industry around it. Within a few, you know, 10 years, basically, that whole industry collapsed. Venezuela still has these reserves, but it is actually currently unable to even refine it, which is technology that they had 30 years ago. The plants are there, just the engineers aren't. The engineers fled the country. They are elsewhere because nobody wants to work for free. That's one. And the second thing is, when you have that much state control, it becomes very repressive because there's no competition. And so the state can make you do whatever they want. Over the years, Venezuela became one of the most repressive countries in the world. By the time Hugo Chavez died, he had stolen 3 elections, and his successor, Nicolas Maduro, has now stolen another 3 in what seems to be one of the most endless misery pits in the world. To put that into context in a real way, Venezuela now is creating almost, if not more, refugees than Syria. Colombia alone has taken in 2 million people. Now, of course, and this is one of the most frustrating things to live with as a South American, you hear particularly liberal people in the United States at every level of both government, but especially media, regurgitate the propaganda that the Venezuelan regime puts out there. So the Venezuelan regime has bankrupted itself because of its high corruption, ridiculous management of funds, and insane repression. That's what has made it a failed state. And yet you'll hear people on MSNBC, CNN, and certain government people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders, and even some people in the Biden administration, regurgitate propaganda from the regime in Venezuela, which basically says that they're broke because the U.S. has been very mean to them and Europe has been very mean to them. But at the same time, aren't you happy as American citizens that the United States refuses to negotiate with a government that treats its citizens in the most abhorrent ways, negotiates with terrorists, and on top of that, is so corrupt that I don't doubt that the Venezuelan people in charge are some of the richest people in the world. It's just that they're taking the money from the country and investing it on themselves instead on the development of people. With that little bit of background context, I am trying to explain why I have conflicting feelings about El Sistema as it originally came about. It is because El Sistema became a propaganda arm of a regime. It seemed like a success. It gave people in the West something to talk about positively about this place. From Colombia, we watched this with some envy, I'm not going to lie. I mean, we saw the type of orchestras that were coming to visit. We saw the type of musicians that were giving masterclasses. You know, the video with Plácido Domingo crying. All of that was amazing. On the other hand, we knew what the United States and Europe seemed to ignore, that this was the first thing that was going to collapse when the funds ran dry, which they would because it was being so mismanaged. And sure enough, as soon as there were no items to buy groceries and inflation hit whatever 100th percentile we're at yet now, El Sistema collapsed. And why is this important? Because El Sistema was seen as this revolutionary model. And in many ways it was. And we talk about that with Stan in our discussion, which I find fascinating. But in some ways, it really wasn't that revolutionary. The guy who started El Sistema, Abreu had traveled to the Midwest in the 1970s-ish, and he had seen the after-school band programs that the United States used to have. They don't have this anymore so much. And he saw an opportunity to bring that to a more impoverished part of the world and serve a double purpose. Now, over time, Abreu saw that this could be implemented in a number of countries. Colombia, Bolivia, Ecuador, Peru, and Venezuela, where he was from. Venezuela was the first to take him up when the commodities boom and when Hugo Chavez took over and he saw an opportunity to make this a propaganda arm of the regime. But, you know, regime aside, the program did incredible things. El Sistema really worked. Why did it work? Because it had worked before in other countries. Now, the thing that was new was really focusing on underserved communities, and that is its strong point. Now, my real joy has been to see that El Sistema was taken, like this idea was rebrought to the United States, where there is incredible philanthropy. And it has been working in insane ways, both at YOLA in LA and with Stan's organization, Play on Philly, and many others around the country to basically serve its original purpose, but in a really sustainable way. Why is it sustainable? Because it's not a propaganda arm of a government. Now, I have had heated discussions, not with Stan, but with other people that really think that the whole point of El Sistema is that it is a socialist thing that is handled by the government. And so it's been, quote unquote, prostituted by the United States and its capitalistic model. I completely disagree. It is working wonders in the United States. It could work wonders in other countries if it could follow the model that it's discovered here in the United States. As such, people like Stan are invaluable to relearn in South America how to do this in a really sustainable way. There are programs that are continuing in sustainable ways, unlike El Sistema in Venezuela. This includes Fundación Batuta in Colombia, Esperanza Azteca in Mexico, and, you know, basically every South American country has one. It's not as expansive as El Sistema was, but it also probably won't collapse. So that is positive, and I think people like Stan will lead the way not just nationally in the United States, but could become an important person to bring this back in a way that works to South America, where it is also, I think, needed. Besides my qualms with El Sistema and everything else, the real reason that I wanted to have Stan on is that he's an example of somebody who wanted to do something specific with music and kind of put his time and effort into it. I see too many people now, and especially after 2020, that want to adopt social causes, but they don't want to sacrifice anything in that route. And I think that's fine, but then you can't talk out both ends. What I mean by this is Stan was clearly in love with having an orchestral life. He went to the Curtis Institute of Music. He worked to a lot of things, but he saw something important when he visited Venezuela, and he wanted this for his community. So what did he do? You know, he rolled up his sleeves and he did that. And to some sacrifices to his personal career, maybe, as a trumpet player. But that doesn't matter, because what he built is so much more amazing. And I have incredible respect for somebody that does this, somebody like Stan, because most people will just continue to do what they do while at the same time preaching some reality or program or desire that they themselves are not willing to put into action. So what I think Stan can serve as is as a model of the type of tenacity required to actually put and implement large projects into the world, to make them a reality. People use the word thought leader a lot, and especially people that don't roll up their sleeves. And I have to say, in our industry, Stanford Thompson is really a thought leader. For this reason, and even if you do not really see your life aligned with Stan Thompson, which is fine, you should know this name. You should study the way he goes about his mission. And if anything, you can learn from that tenacity. I sure have. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Stan Thompson, and I hope you get something out of it that propels your own career. And with that, I leave you with Stan Thompson. So I wanted this for two reasons. First of all, I just wanted to get to know you better, because a lot of what I was hearing at the board of directors meetings that we've had, I really, like, love some of the things you have to say and your perspective on things. But the other part was just, I think for the sake of the podcast, that you're the type of person that I like talking to, because my thing is not really about trumpet playing, and it's more about like interesting people in the community that have good thoughts about the industry, but also about like changes that are happening and all of that. And you're clearly somebody like that. And the other part is like trailblazers and whatnot that are creating their own paths. So you obviously fit that bill. I would like to start with you. Like, I'm just super interested that you are somebody that like reached peak parts of what would be considered like a career and like starting it and everything else in what would be like a traditional trajectory. So, you know, you're at Curtis, you're already like selected among a group of people in that age group. That's insane. I'm curious what led you to your path of like play on Philly and everything else. Because most of the, like I'm an administrator myself, but you know, we run into a lot of like administrators or people that run programs that a lot of them just were not going to make it in a way, or never even hit a bottom level of like the rungs of what would be super competitive playing. So I'm curious, like, let's start there. Like I've your trajectory there and what led you kind of to look to something else and not just stay on kind of the wheel of auditions or whatever.
Sure. So, I mean, some of this goes back to the first 18 years of my life. So my father grew up in the early 40s in Jackson, Mississippi, fought in the Vietnam War. You can put two and two together. He dealt with a lot of stuff personally growing up in Mississippi during those times. And also serving in the military, not being treated, you know, the best, experiencing Vietnam, you know, head on. But when he came back to the States, he was very keen into finishing his education, taking advantage of the GI Bill, being very resourceful, you know, those types of things. My mother grew up in the mid-50s on the south side of Chicago. She was one of seven kids who helped to integrate the Chicago public schools. And facing all sorts of adversity, same thing, growing up in a very challenging community, but surrounded by a lot of love and support, dealing with the types of challenges she did. She met my father at Indiana University, where he was studying music. She was studying business. She grew up as a musician, so she was still playing in a lot of the university ensembles. And when they got married, they decided to compromise by raising their family in Atlanta. My father wanted to stay in the South. My mom wanted to be in a big city. They ended up having eight kids. I'm number seven out of eight. We all had to play a musical instrument at some point. But I think the important part here is that they raised me and my siblings to be resourceful, to like keep eyes wide open, to be realistic about future. Of course, both of them wanted to be professional musicians, but everything didn't line up. Life didn't line up in the right way, the resources, the training, all of these things. By the time they got to me, you know, they had a lot more practice. So my oldest brother went to the New School, studied jazz saxophone there. My next oldest brother studied bass at Curtis. My little sister studied percussion at the Manhattan School of Music. Actually, she was runner-up for Curtis. We almost had three of us at Curtis at the same time.
That's quite a number in one family.
Yeah. And my mom really wanted to go to Stanford University for business school. That's how I got my name. So you tell that to kid young enough, they start to believe they're going to be the businessman of the family. And then the other thing that happened to me was when I was in the eighth grade, Chris Martin moved to town from the Philly Orchestra to become principal trumpet in the Atlanta Symphony. And I was able to study with him from eighth grade all the way up to graduation. I had an insider that not only plays spectacularly well, and it was such a treat to hear him develop as a trumpet player in the symphony. But I mean, he was 23 when he came in, or 24, something like that. And I mean, that just was a huge role model for me. He's such a gentleman, again, amazing musician, great trumpet player. So all of these forces were kind of swirling around in the same pot. Even me and my buddies, when I was 16, we worked together to form the Atlanta Trumpet Festival held at Emory University. So I started cutting my teeth in like what it means to try to convince people for money or space and like try to build community through music. And my first crack at that was with the trumpet community in and around the Atlanta metro area. So all of this stuff happened before I went to college. So here I am sitting at Curtis, real great training, feeling real good about myself, but also understanding what inequity looks like, what it feels like, the reality of building a life with music, and of course me trying to work as hard as I can. And there was a combination of many of my buddies that I was playing better than when we were at Interlochen ended up creeping up and getting just as good, if not better than me, by the time we graduated from school. I had a chance to play in the Seoul Philharmonic for a couple of weeks and kind of was like, I don't know if this life is for me, being an orchestral musician, kind of like I always looked up to Chris. And super exciting, when I went to Philly, he went to Chicago, and that's where my grandma was while she was alive. So I would go out there and hear him. So like that dream of maybe like being a successful like entrepreneur was in my mind because of Emory. I started a nonprofit summer camp in Reading, Pennsylvania. I was running a brass festival in Philadelphia hosted by Curtis, but for the school district kids. I was like hanging out with those musicians that would become Yuja Wong or Ray Chen, brass players in the Met, Cleveland Orchestra, New York Phil, like conductors. Then I had like access to a whole bunch of rich people that supported Curtis and really passionate about education. And in my last semester at Curtis, Gustavo Dudamel was named the music director of the LA Phil and the founder of El Sistema, of course, the program that Gustavo came out of. He won the TED Prize. And there was this like huge blow up about like El Sistema and that world. And I was like, whoa, this is amazing. Using classical music, which I'm passionate with, a group of people that are traditionally left out, you know, in the way they define it, lower socioeconomic, but in our field, people of color involved in classical music, they're doing it at a super high level. I resonate with that, with my training, my time at Curtis, you know, all of this. And like, here's a world that I kind of, I felt like if I didn't get on this train then, I was going to regret. And thinking about like all the skill sets and the interests that I have in music could culminate in something really powerful through what was happening with kind of the El Sistema inspired movement in the United States. So that's really how it kind of all came together for me. And again, keeping my eyes wide open, being resourceful. And that kind of started the process of me kind of switching my attention of being a nonprofit administrator, trying to be a thought leader in kind of the field of classical music, and then also kind of being a social justice advocate as well.
I am super interested in like that era. You know, I was growing up in Colombia when that happened, like when Dudamel was appointed, and everyone in South America looked at El Sistema with a lot of envy. I always looked at it with envy from the point of view of like, wow, these trumpet teachers and conductors don't come to Colombia, and there's obviously a lot of resources being put into this. But I always had skepticism because we're Latin American about where the money was coming from, and I always thought like this is eventually going to collapse because it's a propaganda arm in a way. So like I always had so much respect for Abreu specifically, because he would have made this work anywhere. And in fact, I don't know if you know, but he was like workshopping this before it was finally adopted in Venezuela. He was trying to get it adopted in like Bolivia, Colombia, all sorts of places, and he was amazing. But I always knew that it would collapse, and it was so sad. But I see a lot of hope in it, in the sense that it found a home in different parts of America in a way more sustainable way by not depending on, like, you know, a relatively impoverished and, or, well, at the time they had a lot of money, but, you know, a very corrupt government that was, like, throwing money at something kind of recklessly. So I'm super thrilled that, like, that whole movement inspired people like you and also the LA Phil to take on this project, especially because it's kind of a rebirth of the Midwestern Chicago, you know, school model that existed, you know, from the 50s to, like, 70s-ish, right? So I that's, like, super fascinating that you would be inspired to take that on. And what about it specifically did you see would translate to, like, it being put in a place like the United States? As a, because, like, in Latin America, it's so clear. It's like, you know, there's huge amounts of poverty, and there's already programs like this, like, in soccer or sports about getting people to basically be off the streets and have, like, something to do that, you know, creates a balance between school and after school. And, like, explain to me, like, how that's translated to North America in a way. I mean, I know it's very similar, but, like, how did you find that it would work here?
Yeah. So I would say I agree 1,000% with what you've just said about El Sistema in general.
Right.
And going into it, I knew that there were flaws in the design of El Sistema. You know, first being from, you know, the government support that they receive. Also, I mean, the challenges they have, especially for a program that big, to be consistent with their teaching across the country, in an environment where maybe, like, setting up systems and policies and stuff like that doesn't quite work as the same as you would imagine, like, in the United States. I'm just talking, like, culturally speaking, mm-hmm. where, like, there's one person that's in charge of all these music programs across the country. There's never going to be a situation where there's one person in charge. We just don't work that way here in the United States of America. So there were certain of those constructs that I just knew, like, you know, I wasn't going to run after public money. There is a way to be successful in doing that, but it just wasn't going to scale up for teachers that I knew I would have to pay at least $50 an hour. And I'm not buying, like, $35 basketballs, you know, I'm buying, you know, $1,000 fiddles. So there's just a lot with the way that government money is set up to support these kind of out of school time programs, these after school programs, that just wasn't going to work for this, like, youth orchestra training model that was in El Sistema. So, I mean, certainly, you know, again, the as part of my experience, actually, I was in the inaugural class of Abreu Fellows at the New England Conservatory. And we spent 2 months in Venezuela visiting programs all over the country, from the Andes and the plains, the beaches, the deserts, you know, all that stuff. And it was super eye-opening how each state, each city, each program pretty much was fundamentally different. Until those students really got funneled up into the Simón Bolívar. But anyway, kind of digress about that one. To go back to your question, I knew, and what was super inspiring was, despite all those challenges, how Dr. Abreu could pull together all these complex puzzle pieces and make an experience come to life for hundreds of thousands of kids. And I first thought about how much I dreamed as a, like, 12, 13-year-old, listening to pictures at an exhibition, going to the Atlanta Symphony, like, playing in my first youth orchestra, going to a summer camp, like, how much I just wanted to be part of that family and that energy and those opportunities. And I saw the same type of dreams in the young kids that I met in Venezuela. And I knew that there were the same type of energy of kids in Philadelphia. So I kind of looked at what were the commonalities between behaviors and, you know, kind of like characteristics of people and how people work. That's what I could grab onto to kind of replicate, knowing that there's no way to just take what they did in Venezuela and plant it in U.S. soil. So I really enjoyed and have always enjoyed the puzzle pieces. How do I get a school principal to let me into their building? How do I get the parents to sign up for this program? How do I get my friends to come teach? How do I get donors to give money? How do I get the Philly Orchestra, Curtis, and other partners to provide opportunities? So I love all of that, those puzzle pieces. I really thrive on trying to figure all that out, but, you know, creating a common vision for what all of this could mean in service of young people, and not necessarily in service of the art form or, you know, in benefit of myself personally or my teachers. And what I found over the past 13 years, I'm now actually having the largest independent L system inspired program in the country. You know, it worked quite well to pull all of those pieces together and try to do the work with a lot of integrity and consistency and quality.
I love that about, like, I don't know you very well, obviously, but I read about you and I've heard your TED Talks and stuff. And that's something I really value about you and some other real people that are on the ground doing it. That what you said, like the enjoyment of the puzzle pieces and just like burrowing through to the mission of what you're trying to do. And ultimately having a constituent in mind that benefits from it, that of course it's you in a way because you're getting something out of it internally, but it's in your case the students or the community. And I just think that ironically it's somewhat rare to find people that work with communities in effective ways like this that aren't ignored sometimes. You know what I mean? Like there's flashier versions of you out there that don't actually get the work done, and everyone suffers essentially, even though vast amounts of funding is getting thrown their way. And so it's incredibly amazing to me, like the amount of work that you put into this, and it makes sense that you would enjoy the puzzle piece making. It's also what I always valued about Oreo. I always thought that he was like the slyest, I mean this in a good way, the slyest fox. And there's a thing, I think, I can't remember if it's Virgil, but I remember reading this once that it's like where the pelt of the lion fails, you must eke it out with a little fox. That's how I felt about him. And I just love that attitude. And where do you think that comes from for you? Is it just growing up in a big family, or is it that the mission's so important to you that you're just determined to plow through it?
So I think it's a combination of going through this stuff myself, of how, I mean, I can't tell you the evenings that I sat in Atlanta Symphony Orchestra concerts completely transformed in a completely different space, feeling like I'm, you know, time has stood still around me. I think about the same thing at night, sitting in my cabin at Interlochen. And here I am making music with, and really art, with visual artists and musical theater and dancers, all this stuff. But even within music, of like, again, sitting there at night, just dreaming of the type of career, the people that I was meeting, bringing into my life. And anyway, so that has gone on and on. And my thing is like, this is such a vibrant world of classical music. There's so many great people out there that are giving like hundreds of millions of dollars so that musicians can make music all over the country. And many of them are very generous outside of giving money, opening up their homes, their lives for the musicians, and doing all sorts of things. So I think that resonated. But at the same time, I watched my parents like kill themselves essentially to help their kids that they were teaching and help their own children that they had, me and my siblings. And I just thought that like being at Curtis, like I was just looking around, just saying like, there are all these resources, that obviously we're spending at Curtis, but there are all these people we're leaving out in our backyard, just a couple of blocks from us. And then we wonder, why aren't they showing up for our concerts? Why aren't we having more impact with this music other than, you know, I remember going up to Carnegie Hall playing a concert with Alan Gilbert with the Curtis Symphony. It was probably the best concert I've ever played in my life. I was on a complete high throughout the performance. And then afterwards, it just felt like after the last vibrations died down in the hall, the only people that experienced it were the ones that were there that night. And to me, that kind of painted this picture of like, it's great that I'm having this impact right here in these rooms, you know, from time to time. But like, I just don't feel like those vibrations are going outside these walls and impacting lives the way that I watch my parents impact lives and change lives forever, for years and years and years to come. And I just was like all of this could be better. It could be more. And that's like, I was searching for something. And when I found out about El Sistema, I was like, yes, this is like classical music resonating in the lives of now millions of people that have gone through it. And then think about the millions of people that know that the other millions of people that went through it had their lives impacted by this art. So, you know, they've created their own ecosystem that, as flawed as it is, I think is very beautiful. So that's the part where I'm like, let's try to make something like this happen, you know, in the US. And I think, I mean, this is what I'm going to be dedicated to for the rest of my professional career. Trying to do things in a different way than they have traditionally been done. I have a lot to learn, a lot to, you know, try to influence, but I'm pretty excited about changing what impact looks like in our space, how that resonates with people, and then how that can help them go out and hopefully do good things in the world.
Yeah, I've had similar feelings and have been somewhat frustrated by two versions of like outreach that orchestras do, and to some degree universities, but universities are in a different position. They offer a different service, right? But one version of this is basically we're going to reach bigger audiences by repeating Peter and the Wolf indefinitely and Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, which are beautiful pieces that I loved as a kid, and even now, but it's clearly not paying off the dividends that somebody in the 70s told them it would. That's one side of it. But the other side of it that I've grown frustrated too with is everyone has diagnosed the disease. So everyone has diagnosed the cancer, like, okay, the dwindling audiences, we're not reaching the communities, people in the cities don't feel represented by this. But I think that the medicine proposed is like the easiest medicine. Like everyone is always going to the easiest, and they want to hire the person that tells them the easy thing. It's like, oh, all your financial woes, all your audience woes, all this, I can solve by doing X, you know? And I've always thought by the time you get to the symphony orchestra with some of these solutions that are being proposed for community building, first of all, I find some of them like very stereotypical and coming from people that, even though they might share an ethnic background, don't really understand the communities that they think they're serving. I'll speak for myself, like from Latin American perspective, like some of the people I see like supposedly talking to the Latino community, it's like, yeah, but you didn't like look for somebody that's actually embedded in these neighborhoods. You hired somebody that, you know, grew up in upper middle class America but just happens to have Latin American descent, and this person's solutions don't speak to like a socioeconomic divide that maybe it's more stark to me because I grew up in a very divided socioeconomic country. So that's another part of it that I think programs like what you've started and El Sistema in general like sees very clearly. It's like the problem with welcoming people is not the final product. The problem starts from, you know, 20 years down behind you where like I had access to music education and somebody else didn't. That's one thing. But the second thing is what you mentioned, which I can totally relate with. I remember being in Colombia and like anytime an orchestra would visit or going to the local symphony concerts, being like transfixed by what was presented and just completely transported and listening to, you know, Hoke on every night as when I was getting better at the trumpet and being completely transfixed with this and realizing later in life that this is not a unique experience that other people should not have access to, but we are doing a horrible job at letting people know that they can participate in this. I mean, I think a lot like orchestras now have super accessible tickets all the time and sometimes free concerts, but we're still not attracting those communities, which means that we're doing a very poor job at letting them know that this belongs to them in a meaningful way. And part of it is things like Play on Philly do help that, because I heard an interview of yours that I loved something you said, which is the kid is learning violin, but the parent is also seeing the amount of effort it takes to learn the violin or the trumpet. And so when they both go to a concert, there's a different appreciation of what's happening. So that's one thing I heard that I loved. And the other thing I love is this idea that part of what makes this work is that the quality or like the type of art that you're presenting has to be like has to match the like full cultural value of what it can offer. So if I'm presenting a concert in a place that doesn't usually get music, part of the thing I hate is that some of those concerts are really dumbed down to make them quote unquote like musically accessible. And to me, it's like you should be presenting the best things here. Like you should hit them with like the most valuable parts of the culture, not the easiest parts of it. Because in a way, they need an access point that's like as glorious as some of the ones we've had, if that makes sense. So
yeah.
Because I feel like not enough people talk poetically about what we do the way you just did, like what it means for the culture and for all of us to be part of it. So like, how do you access those points besides just like teaching an instrument to somebody? Like, what are the touch points there?
Yeah. So I do think that there is a correlation between kind of the passion that people bring to, in my case, with Play on Philly. The passion they bring to teaching young people, the respect that they have for them, knowing that they're starting on a process that is challenging, frustrating at times. We've all wanted to throw our trumpets against the wall. but we do this with a lot of love. We do this knowing that they can pick up and try again. We understand that these kids can accomplish anything. And it's frustrating because we have all been there, but we're not there to judge them. And we're there every single day after school, in our case, working with them, practicing with them, mentoring them, and then cheering them on for their performances. And I think making music in that type of environment where you're doing it with your friends that you know and you trust and everybody sucks at the same time. And, you know, this ends up being a whole kind of community initiative that they pick up really quickly, that while they don't want to disappoint their friends, they don't want to disappoint the teacher or, you know, even their parents at a performance, they can start to build that sense of like accountability very, very early on in a very supportive environment. And then I think the other thing that's really important is that I've been in too many spaces in classical music where I am the only Black person in the room. Nico, you probably have a very similar experience.
I mean, it's a little different for me because I feel like, you know, I feel like Latin America is so, especially Colombia, it's so blended that it's really hard to tell where somebody's from. So I feel like Latinos blend in the mix in much different ways than the Black community.
I can get behind that.
Yeah.
But I'll just say from a cultural standpoint, mm-hmm. you know what it's like to be in a room where you don't share the same cultural kind of background and experiences with a large number of people.
Sure.
Now, I have learned to adapt in a lot of spaces, but it sure feels good when I go and play with the Gateways Orchestra or the Sphinx Symphony Orchestra. Like, I'm around my people. I can really, truly myself. So, you know, I really, I think about the type of environment we do all of this in. And then also I think about the barriers. And I think one thing that's super unique about Play on Philly is that we want to remove all the barriers of access possible. So no tuition, We loan instruments to the kids. We are there at their schools, practicing with them. Almost anything that they need to fully engage, we provide. If it's transportation, if they need a t-shirt, if they need to keep their instruments in good working order, so that the kids can concentrate on, playing, and the parents also can be supported, and they can kind of go through a process learning how all of this works. And I would say that with kind of those two things working together, where you have, an organization that really understands holistically what the kids are going through. We understand their challenges that the parents have, that they have, removing barriers, and I think providing opportunities for their kids to be, rock stars. I think that's a huge like recipe to kind of keep this stuff moving forward. And at the end of the day, it's classical music. They're learning to play in an orchestra. And like the parents and the kids ultimately don't care. I mean, but they care about the environment that they're in. They care how they're treated, they care about how they're seen, how they're supported. And that's where I think that we get a lot of stuff wrong. And it's like that in a lot of other spaces, quite frankly, that are dominated by white people, or maybe even dominated by other kind of cultural groups, let's say from higher socioeconomic backgrounds. Nico, before this podcast, we were talking about skiing, how much I've been skiing. And yeah, you want to talk about being in another predominantly white space, with a lot of wealthy people. But I'm sitting there like, look, I know how to hang with this. But I also know how to be myself when I'm out there. I also know how to bring my friends along that I would really love to share the slopes with. And then also, the thing that I really love about kind of the ski community, a lot of people don't take themselves very seriously. There's a lot of bad skiers and snowboarders out there. But we're all out there because we enjoy the views. We enjoy the time together on the lifts, in the lodge. We know that it's healthy for us, mentally, emotionally. It is also, good for us, in addition to physically. And these are all things that I really wish that classical music could embrace more. And instead of shutting people out, how do we bring people in? How do we prioritize adding value into the lives of other people rather than we have practiced so much, we sound so good, we want people to come out to hear how good we sound. And, of course, let there be this passive way, or as you're mentioning, let's do outreach, and try to bring something into the lives of other people through an artistic lens. So those are all things that I'm like gently pushing back from. And at the same time, I'm trying to show my colleagues it's okay to be the worst sounding youth orchestra in Philadelphia, but we are rewarded handsomely for it. And Nico, I'll never forget, probably about like 5, 6 years ago, our kids gave a performance of Beethoven's First Symphony. And it's the worst performance that has of Beethoven's First Symphony that has ever taken place in the city of Philadelphia. But that room had to be full with 400 to 500 of their family members. And I would say the vast majority that had never heard that piece before. And they could care less that it was Beethoven's First Symphony. They were so excited that their kids have gone from Twinkle Twinkle to Beethoven's First Symphony, a substantial piece of music in a 5 or 6 year period of time. And to watch their kid grow over all of that, to watch their kids connect with other friends, do something positive, be applauded, constantly be in the newspapers and the TVs, to have opportunities as they grew older to get scholarships for college, like that's adding value. And when the orchestra is seen as doing that, and when classical music is seen as doing it, it broke down all of these walls between a community that traditionally doesn't engage with classical music to something that is really meaningful, that they are starting to build their own vocabulary and experience around.
I love that also because it's, I mean, it reminds me of two things. First of all, it's very tied to like the history of American orchestras in general. Like now that we all have, you know, Cleveland Orchestra and Chicago Symphony and Decca contracts or Deutsche Grammophon, we forget that these were all amateur orchestras. I mean, I love Joseph Horowitz's books about this, that it really details like, it's kind of recent that professional orchestras are a thing in North America, in Europe as well, but especially in North America. And a lot of these things were just community building for, you know, European arrivals, essentially, and not all of them had money. So first of all, I like that link. But the other thing that I like about how you're thinking about this is I've seen it work in many other communities. Like the Asian community is a good example of this. Like I work with I think they're like mostly Korean, but also some other like Chinese, I think, are in there. Not so many Japanese people, but like they have a thing here called like the Los Angeles Youth Philharmonic something. And they hire like professionals to do to sit in and fill in parts. And it's exactly what you just described. Like some of these performances are just like horrible. Some of them are like some kids that are coming out of it now are insanely talented. But what you can tell is, and a lot of these parents don't even speak English, you know, like they clearly are not like, some of them are affluent, but some of them really aren't. And what you see is exactly what you're saying. It's just the glee of this community that their kids went from Twinkle Twinkle to whatever they're performing and how insanely powerful that is. And so I'm 100% sure that this translates through any other community. And that's basically what you're confirming with what you're doing, at least, or what you've been doing, which is just, there's a formula here that can be done that brings people into the fold, as opposed to trying to like grab them from a different place and bring them to your existing structure. And in that regard, I also feel like orchestras do have some blame in this game, and professionals in orchestras have some blame in this game, in that, God, the amount of money that some of these places have is insane. And there's very little concern, even from some musicians that I've talked to, about who they're serving. And by that, I mean, like, I think that a lot of them just think that people are there to see them specifically. And in reality, you're serving that audience. I mean, like, no orchestra on earth actually generates a revenue. They all operate at a loss even when they sell out. So, like, it's all by the virtue of generosity that these places exist, and they should feel a stronger mandate about who they serve and what those people sitting in that audience are supposed to be experiencing when they're there. That is not just like the most perfectly executed, you know, Strauss you've ever heard.
Correct. And yeah, if I was running one of these big orchestras, I would want in my community for there to be dozens of kids and adults and everything in between playing instruments, playing in ensembles, and really kind of anchoring the orchestra as the culminating place, not necessarily the destination, but the culminating place for that energy. That's what I would do. And when I'm out there on these mountains and all this stuff, I don't know. I mean, imagine if the Winter Olympics was trying to get people to watch, but we really didn't want to encourage people to go out on skis and snowboards themselves and like build a love for it. And when you think about it, like you got simple people like me that don't make a lot of money, mm-hmm. that's willing to spend a lot of money to be out there. you know, and so I would put two and two together to say, maybe I should work with the people making the equipment, and I should be working with the people that run these mountains, and we should set up like World Cup locations all over, not just wait every 2 or 4 years, whatever, for the Olympics, like keep this energy going, and keep people like developing ski schools. And I mean, there, as you know, in many of these towns, like they're the towns that like actually give class credit to bring kids to the slopes. And you know, so anyway, not to digress too much, but I'm just there's something in this construct of like, we don't want to build community in this space, but then we dare to say, why isn't the community here.
Yeah.
To hear us, support us, and all that.
Well, and that's what I mean, that sometimes I find, like, some of the solutions that orchestras are recommended to come up with, to me, just seem like, it's exactly what you're saying. Like, there's a bigger issue here that's not going to be solved no matter how much money you throw at this specific problem internally. And that's exactly, like, what you're describing with the ski thing is exactly how I feel about the orchestra and what we consider access barriers, so to speak, that I largely think are somewhat of a myth as far as finances. Because, like, they always say, well, the problem is the ticket. It's like, well, yeah, but not every ticket costs $150, for example. And the other thing is, I've gone to, like, forget ski slopes where, like which are, like, that's one example. But, like, think about, like, I've been to Disney and seen, like, very lower middle class and poor people spend hundreds of dollars with, like, all their family, and you're seeing them there, or baseball games. I went to a baseball game, my girlfriend took me to a baseball game for the first time, I think 2 years ago, and I was just shocked at, like, the amount of working class Mexican people that I saw there. And I know, because I know people in these communities, I'm like, you're not wealthy, and here you are, you each paid, like, $80. You're here with, like, 9 or 10 people. This is like an $800 seat, basically, this row. And you're purchasing, like, $20 hot dogs. And I thought in that moment is, like, yeah, but baseball's in every school. Baseball is beloved by these people. These teams spent a lot of time making them feel like they're part of a bigger thing, that they're all should be involved in. Same with Disney, like, the amount of advertisement Disney does to make you feel like you're part of something, even though you're not involved in the company at all. Yeah. We do none of that. I mean, the amount of marketing that is spent in orchestras here is vast. I mean, for the size of the orchestras. And yet I feel like mostly it's not about that. It's mostly about their internal product and not about what you're saying. Like, how are we all working together to create a healthy environment that feeds itself all the time? Even if we were just to think about it away from the social component, which we can't, but, you know, we're just doing this very poorly from the largest institutions.
Yeah, I feel the same way. So, yeah, it's a huge opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I say, like, I think I got another good 30, 35 years of my professional career ahead of me. I'm excited about what I'm doing. I'm excited about what's next. And, you know, I mean, there's plenty of space. And if I were one of these orchestras, I'd be a little nervous about, you know, a well-connected person coming into my community and starting something. Because we don't have to be the best sounding orchestra in Philadelphia. We just got to be the best connected to the community. And I think, you know, helping to address, like, problems of, like, the normal people to attract a level of support. And again, it's a play right out of Dr. Abreu's book. Because as you know the story, there were two professional orchestras when he got started in Maracaibo and in Caracas. And his whole thing was, like, those orchestras didn't have Venezuelans in them. So he wanted to create his own system. You mentioned earlier about Europeans coming to the States. Well, orchestras, it was part of their culture. And they developed these orchestras. I mean, they were working in factories during the day, but they pull their violins and trumpets and trombones out and perform. You know, those weren't 52-week orchestras for a very, very long time, probably until the past 50, 60 years. So, you know, it's something similar. It's just they wanted to add value to their community. And then it just happened to be, especially with American orchestras, some of those people became real rich, running the big factories and, you know, kind of paving the way to become patrons of, you know, the orchestra. So I like to think the same thing. We got a lot of kids that are starting their careers in college. They're going to be okay. They also have the skill sets to be very successful in the future. Those are the people that I want to cultivate to help run the Wakanda Symphony Orchestra that I want to start in 15 years. So anyway, I just kind of think that if it could happen for a bunch of Europeans that were coming over, developing orchestras, developing settlement music schools and all this stuff, community music schools, we can do it again with a different population. If Dr. Abreu can do it with a different population, figure out how to plant those kind of fundamental elements into their soil, I think we could do a similar thing here.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And also, like this, I love this concept of like, you don't have to reinvent the wheel at every turn. You know what I mean? Like, I know that's not pretty much, that's not what you're saying, but like, I also find like every music thing that's trying to like change the paradigm, a lot of them are trying methods that, I mean, you already have one that, like you said, works really well. You know, and that has a proven track record across cultures. And I'm really excited that, you know, the field has somebody like you. And the other thing I hear from you that I just want to highlight for people that will listen to this is like, you have an optimism that's very grounded in like the reality of a market that exists out there. And I love that. That it's like, okay, here's what we can do, and here's an opportunity. I'm very good friends with an economist that went, he teaches in a university in Mexico, and he's having his moment because his dissertation at Stanford was about like changing economies and like allocation of resources when that happens, when an economy shifts and then the pandemic happened. So he's having his moment.
Wow,
And
that's
one thing
nice.
he says is exactly that, like, we're too used to seeing crumbling infrastructure as a tragedy when we should see it as an opportunity, because that means that there's like a hole that somebody's not filling. And like you said, who says that you can't create an orchestra in many of these cities that will rival institutions that think they're very cemented, and could easily be replaced? The one I think about all the time is the circus. Like, the circus kept doing its same thing over and over again, and there was less and less want for it until you end up with like the two big ones and places like Barnum and Bailey, who just like went on a talent war and bankrupted all the other circuses because they could offer bigger salaries and better benefits and all this other stuff. And out of nowhere, these French Canadians come around. They say, we're not, you know, we're going to change this paradigm, and it's going to be look completely different from what you're used to being a circuit, and then bankrupted all of them. And now they're like a $2 billion empire, which is Cirque du Soleil. And I'm really interested in that kind of concept. Like, things are not static, and anyone that thinks that you can just create the same model but healthier constantly, you're gonna go the way of the dinosaur.
Look, I think of the New World Symphony in Miami. Very similar story. But there's also an opportunity for the newer World Symphony to open its doors in Miami and do something different. I think one just has to fundamentally believe that there is a marketplace for many different stakeholders. And I just believe that there's a marketplace of donors that, they don't really want to see the Philly Orchestra spend $300,000 per day. And lift up another group of people, and that there just might be musicians that are willing to work on a different contract, audition in a different process. So I fundamentally believe all of that exists. And it's been a joy. We've raised over $20 million for Play on Philly since we started in 2010. And we're able to invest almost $3 million a year in these kids. I would have never thought that we would be able to raise $3 million for the worst sounding youth orchestra, or raise $3 million to pay for teachers that go out every single day, not just Saturday morning, or pay for a 6-week summer camp and take over Temple University and have the kids for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week for 6 weeks. So, it might be crazy to think like, huh. Could there be another vibrant orchestra in New York City, Chicago, Boston, that's vibrant, like everybody's talking about? Everybody wants to go to the concert. People are supporting. They're buying tickets. We got sponsors that want to, sponsors the classical music world never thought would ever be around the table, donors that might switch sides. I just need to find a billionaire. And I always say this, I'm a billionaire away from making this new orchestra. And it's like Michael Tilson Thomas found the Aaronsons.
Mm-hmm.
That's how that all got started.
Right.
And he just, I think the story was sitting in a hotel lobby having a conversation with him. And next thing you know, they purchased the old theater there on that strip, the famous strip. I forget what it's called. Brickell. Gosh, I'll think about it in a second. Yeah. So it's like, that's all it took.
Yeah.
And he was able to plant a seed. And now look at, New World Center. I mean, look at the orchestra they have. I mean, who they're attracting to be there. And it's like, it's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So those types of paradigms. And we could talk about for the next hour, the ones in the business world and, in the environment and all of these other spaces. But
well, Stan, thank you. I know you have a heart out, so we'll have to do this again sometime. But yeah, this is great, man. I'm just so happy you're out there. And yeah, it's great.
Yeah. We'll keep this conversation going.
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll talk again soon. Thanks for everything.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.